there are some people who might claim that these protests are doing us a great service because, you know, I was just talking to somebody here. It's very, very easy to criticize and protest Israel without going into Hamas propaganda and anti-Semitism. It's super easy. I do it all the time. But for some reason, these protests never managed to do that. So they're really showing us what they stand for, and they're proud of it. I mean, not proud enough to take off their masks, but proud enough to go out with signs that say, you know, Al-Qassam brigades like are going to attack these students. And the more Americans know about it, the more, you know, maybe some action could be taken.
Hello and welcome to the Anne and Phelan Scoop. It's just me, Phelan McAleer, today because Anne McElhinney is off in New York working on our new play, October 7th. In fact, she's on a plane now as I speak. It is literally a packed show today. We're bringing you two interviews today, you know, because, you know, one is not good enough. There's so much going on in the world, you know. I'm going to try and cover everything, but if I don't, forgive me. So what's on today's show? Well, Jews are now being officially expelled from so-called elite universities by the students, and the administrators are facilitating them. We're talking to Yael Bartur, who has been one of the most active voices exposing the rot and the anti-Semitism that is prevalent today, not only in the universities, but increasingly in society. You won't want to miss the interview. We cover a lot. We cover Weimar Republic. We cover the play in New York. And it's a very, very, and we cover, do facts care about your feelings? So you won't want to miss that interview. Oh, and of course, global warming. Spring is turning to summer and the world still has not drowned or burned or done anything that climate activists say is going to happen. They may throw oil at paintings and they may block freeways, but the doom has not arrived with the gloom. So we're going to be talking to Tom Nelson, a great voice in the climate world. He's just produced a movie about why these people are the dupes of the biggest scam ever. And so from prize-winning author to prize-winning idiot, how can you be stabbed 14 times by an Islamic fascist and still believe that the biggest threat to your safety is Donald Trump? Well, we'll introduce you to somebody who does believe that. And gender ideology is collapsing around Europe. We bring you the latest and ask, when is it going to happen in the US? So we're going to go straight now to the interview with Yael Bartur. It's a great interview. We cover a lot of ground. Yael is one of the best communicators in the world at the moment. And let's go straight over to the interview that I recorded earlier. You won't want to miss this. So we're joined now by Yael Bartur. She's a communications expert in New York, was formerly the head of the NYPD social media. She's very impressive. She is a great communicator. And we're here to talk to her about how she's using her skills to tell the truth about Israel and to combat, I suppose, mainstream media and also social media misinformation. So thanks so much for joining us, Yael.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. I had wanted to talk to you about the misinformation. I had wanted to talk to you about our play, October 7th, which you're helping us with. Thank you. But actually, I suppose we're filming this on Monday afternoon. I want to talk about the breaking news on Columbia, but I suppose it's not breaking news. The breaking news that has taken 10 years to come to this conclusion. Breaking news on Columbia and other campuses. If you don't follow alternative sources of media, you may not be fully aware of what's going on, say, for example, in Columbia, in the heart of New York. Tell us what's going on there. Give us the details, because the details are shocking.
Yeah. So, you know, for the last few days, we've seen protests erupt around the country, around the U.S. since October 8th, really. But in the last few days, especially at some campuses, specifically Columbia, they've become, you really can't call them protests anymore. I think they're bullying, intimidation, and really calls for bombing of Jews, harassment of Jewish students on campus, bombing of Israel, destruction of the state of Israel. That's kind of, you know, that's normal activity right now on campus. And when Jewish or Israeli students push back, they're told all of a sudden that these campuses are very, very strong believers in freedom of speech. Even though I think the things I mentioned don't really fall under freedom of speech because they're direct calls for violence and harassment. So what we're seeing right now is, I think what we're seeing right now is something very important, which is Jews not staying silent. And not just Jews. I think anybody who cares about anybody who is disturbed by one of the most elite universities in the country, seeing people with their faces covered in keffiyehs shouting to bomb Tel Aviv. What these people are doing are trying to silence people. And what we see as a result of people saying, no, we're not going to be silent about this and we're going to call it out.
I mean, there's so much of what you just said there. I just want to take it apart bit by bit. The argument, this is freedom of speech. Well, you know, most people would agree that you can't encourage or incite violence, right? Or you can't incite violence through freedom of speech. But even, let's just say that these acclamations or whatever you call them are not inciting violence, and that the university says, well, everyone has a right to protest, everyone's a right to freedom of speech. We know that this is not true, that we know that they did not care and, in fact, actively conspired against conservatives or anyone who diverted from the left-leaning narrative and stopped them from speaking on campuses, did not protect them, did not arrest protesters, did not allow a heckler's veto. If you protested long, even if you threatened to protest, suddenly conservatives were banned from speaking because for security reasons. So they only find the freedom of speech argument when it comes, it seems, to threatening and harassing and bullying Jews.
Yeah. And also, it's very true what you're saying. But also, I would say, you know, they can't guarantee the safety of Jewish students, so they effectively end up shutting them down. So I don't know if you remember this, but in Hanukkah, at the end of December last year, Chabad, the Jewish organization on campus at Harvard, put up a menorah, which is, you know, the light that symbolizes the holiday. And they were told every night that they have to put it back. They can't leave it outside because the campus can't guarantee that people won't vandalize it. And, you know, one incident like that is, you know, if it was in isolation, you could say maybe but at some point, administrators and frankly, Americans just need to get up and say, no, we're not going to tell people, you know what, just maybe don't leave the house because you might get attacked for being Jewish. That's not who we are anymore.
Don't wear your Jewish skirt so short, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I wrote this on Twitter the other day, and I have a lot of sympathy for the students who are there and they're scared, and I'm not minimizing that. I would be scared as well. But we are not, this is not the 1930s, and we're not in the shtetl anymore.
Well, we'll come to the 1930s now. That's an interesting thing you said. But I just want to say, like, so these universities, most of them now, I think it's 100,000, you know, hey, it's, you know, It's 100,000 a year. It might not be quite 100,000, but it's the guts of 100,000 a year per student. I think they could spare one security guard to guard a menorah from the hours of 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. That's just me. Or, hey, there's a, you know, if only they could use their best brains to invent something, it would be like a device that would record people's images, right? And you could call it something like a camera. Right,
maybe one that's even so small you can put it in your hand.
Yes, or even you can put it on a pole high above, and you could record people, and then you could then, if only there was a way of kind of punishing people for damaging property.
Yeah,
you could call it like arresting and prosecuting them.
Yeah, and you know, this isn't about. I hear a lot of officials and even people, very well meaning people, say, you know, we need to help the Jewish students feel safe. We need to ensure their safety. But I want to ask, I think that the much deeper question is, how did we get here to this point where our students, our fellow classmates, who are our friends and our colleagues, are yelling for the genocide of Jews? The secondary issue is making sure the Jews feel safe. I think the first issue is, why is this happening in our campuses? What have we done to, as administrations, to allow it?
Yeah, well, actually, funny, I wanted to come on to that with you because now you tweeted last week that persecution starts with the Jews, but it doesn't end with them. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I
would disagree with you on that in this particular set of circumstances. And maybe we're agreeing, but just wording it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this is slightly different. That it started with the persecution of the white cis males and the, you know, straight people. You know, it started with that attacking the patriarchy. You know, the usual left wing tropes, and you know, and now it's just an excuse coming. You know, it comes home to the Jews as it always did. You know, Hitler, the Nazis started off attacking the decadence of the mm-hmm. Weimar Republic, and you know, before you know, and then they just threw that aside. That was an excuse. They, you know, they blamed it on the Jews in the end. So is this different? I mean, it doesn't matter. It's the same. Are they using a different playbook or the same old playbook? Or tell me about it. You probably know the playbook a bit, little better than I do. Go ahead.
Well, I think the broader point is the more important one here, which is to say this isn't just our problem. You know, like I said, I would be very concerned if I was just a regular person who loves America and loves freedom. And it doesn't matter if you're on the left or on your right. You can be a huge Biden supporter, you could be MAGA, but I'd like to think that you wouldn't get to a situation where you think that support of a legitimate, flourishing Western ally of the United States is grounds for you to get, you know, spat on, beat up, and not be able to walk through campus harassed. So, you know, the broader point is here is that this is a problem, and you know, it's a similar. I hate making the Holocaust comparisons, but it's kind of hard not to. But you know, at the end of the day, these are societal problems that are going to affect all of society at large. The Jews, we're just out here waving and saying like, hey, you know, watch out, because this is not a good direction that we're going in.
Yeah, I mean, you said it's not 1930, but we are actually having Jewish students being blocked by other students from coming on campus.
And people on social media and journalists minimizing it.
I want to ask you about that. Are people aware of what's happening on these campuses, or is the mainstream media minimizing this? Tell me, it's hard to say.
I saw a note in the New York Times that said something about some Jewish students reported feeling unsafe, which I thought was very, very silly. Also, you know, if you're a Jewish student who supports the destruction of the state of Israel, yes, you're probably fine and not unsafe. But, you know, some Jewish students being Israeli or being Zionist, which is, you know, probably most of them. And then the other thing is, and you mentioned this earlier, it's just the double standard, right? What I heard a wonderful congressman speak the other day at the hearing of the president of Colombia, whose name is, I think, Burgess Owens, from Utah, a Black conservative. And he said, you would never allow, if this was happening to a Black student, you would never allow this. If it was happening to a gay student, you would never allow this. So it's very hard to buy the you know, all of a sudden that everybody is interested in freedom of speech and freedom of protest, since they've been so inconsistent. Look, if they were consistent across the board, we could at least say, all right, well, this is the value of the university. But we've seen time and time again that they're not. So what is it?
Yeah. Well, where does this end? I'm not asking where it ends societally. We'll get on to that. But where does this particular standoff end? I mean, I know they arrested people last week, but they arrest these people and then the charges are dismissed. And they, you know, all it does is increase the speaker fees for the people who are arrested. They put it in their bio, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true. I think people who support them will continue supporting them, and people who oppose them will continue opposing them. I don't know that anything will change. I think maybe more regular Americans will see this on the news or kind of and say, like, you know what, this is not cool. And I've seen some people weigh in on this who I have never seen weigh in on things like this before, which is encouraging. So you know, hopefully there are some people who might claim that these protests are doing us a great service because, you know, I was just talking to somebody here. It's very, very easy to criticize and protest Israel without going into Hamas propaganda and anti-Semitism. It's super easy. I do it all the time. But for some reason, these protests never managed to do that. So they're really showing us what they stand for, and they're proud of it. I mean, not proud enough to take off their masks, but proud enough to go out with signs that say, you know, Al-Qassam brigades like are going to attack these students. And the more Americans know about it, the more, you know, maybe some action could be taken.
Yeah. Do you think these elite colleges, it'll damage their standing, or are they impregnable? Are they this government protected government?
Yeah,
monopoly?
I don't know. I wish they'd be reformed. I'm not one of the people who thinks we should never, you know, we should boycott them and drive them to the ground. I'm a graduate of an elite university myself, and I want my degree to still mean something. but also, you know, the same way we look at the UN or Amnesty International, all these organizations, mm-hmm. it's upsetting the way they're double standard and how captured they are. But it's also upsetting because we want these institutions to work, right? We want there to be a good Amnesty. We want there to be a good UN. We want there to be a good Columbia. But right now, it's not. They're not living up to their own standards.
I'm not sure now that I agree with you on... Actually, funny, I've always had problems with the UN. Any organization that gives equal weight and standing to Yemen and Finland, you know, it's yeah. like, you know, these are not equal countries. These are not,
yeah.
you know, you don't give the same vote to Sudan as you do to mm-hmm. Sweden, you know? And, you know, Sweden is no paradise either. But, yeah. you know, there are qualitative differences to countries. Mm-hmm. You know, and
maybe that's the new era we're heading into. I don't know, but it's a shame what we have right now doesn't work.
Yes, yes. Enough about you. Let's talk about me. you're helping us with the October 7th
yeah.
play, and thank you for that. So you basically ran after the October 7th attacks on your Twitter account. You basically had a mini October 7th play. Almost every day. Tell people about what you did after October 7 on your Twitter account.
Yeah. So I'm Israeli. I don't know that I mentioned that. I was born and raised there, and I happened to be on October 7th in Israel visiting my family. And you know, like everybody, I went through all the motions and still haven't, you know, still haven't stopped really. Of anger and shock and fear and then anger again and disbelief. And I just did what I know how to do best, which is tell human stories. It's what I've been doing for my whole career, and it's what I enjoy doing as well. And I couldn't keep up. I couldn't keep up. I mean, I still, even if I start again today, 7 months later, I still wouldn't be able to keep up because the amount of stories of people, of humans, of heroism, of last words, of strangers giving their lives for others. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So I wanted to like memorialize these people somehow. And it was honestly a great privilege to be able to do that yeah. and be able to yep. sometimes yep. share with the family members of people and say, hey, you know, if for small comfort, but I wanted to say, show you that your daughter who was killed, you know, 100,000 people liked her photo and said, you know, and thousands of people sent their prayers from all over the world. Yeah. And now I'm still, you know, trying to do that, really trying to focus on the hostages because there are 133 hostages who have been held for 199 days in Gaza. We're recording mm-hmm. this tonight is Passover. It's the freedom festival, and we're none of us are free right now because of, you know, 133 people aren't.
Yeah. Just to let you, I don't know if you know, we're going to do something about the hostages in the play.
Oh, good.
It's a secret at the moment, but we're definitely, that's, I spoke to the director and so we're going to acknowledge that and make a point about that. I mean, you spoke earlier about it being a privilege. And privilege is a much overused word. And I often hate when journalists use, oh, it was a privilege, right? But I unfortunately found myself using that word and meaning it because we went there and we interviewed these people. And it was really was a privilege and it was an honor. It was amazing. Not amazing that they trusted us with our story, because I've interviewed enough victims of trauma and of the troubles and all that to know that a lot of people want to talk. But it was great that they trusted us that we would tell the story correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think people want their story heard, especially nowadays when we hear so many people tell us that it didn't happen, or, you know, it's really, we're seeing kind of Holocaust denial in real time. And also, I think, Philip, and I don't know how much you and Anne felt this when you were there, but the acknowledgement of people outside the Jewish world is really meaningful, because we feel very much alone, even though there's some Jews who are not, you know, completely understanding what's happening. So yesterday I went to an exhibition here in New York for the Nova Festival, which is really beautiful. And I had two friends with me who both happen to be non-Jewish and very, very, very deeply affected by October 7th. And I introduced them to there was a survivor there from the Nova Festival. And he got so emotional when I told him my friends weren't Jewish. Because it's just, you know, it's something that we feel. So, you know, thank you for seeing us, really.
Oh, the more I work on this project, actually, I think only I think, maybe not, but I definitely think only a non-Jew could have made this play. Actually, funny enough, I think the people who were in it are too close. There's too much going on. It's very hard for them to tell their story in a way that will grab people. I just feel that we had the right level of distance, but the right amount of empathy and understanding of how story works and how journalism works to tell
the
story.
And we're very cynical now, the Israelis too, so it helps that you're not cynical.
No, I'm not cynical, but I'll tell you, it was the first time in our lives that being Irish was a negative. I'm serious. So normally,
what's going on,
Luke,
with the Irish?
Listen, don't. Oy vey.
Oy vey. I want to
go. It's a shanda.
The cliffs in Kerry. I want to go drink Guinness, and I don't know.
I don't know. So yeah, I mean, we were there when the Taoiseach, the gay Taoiseach, who's the greatest man in the history of the world, you know, the gay Prime Minister of Ireland, who's just you know, he's on everyone's invite list. He, the Irish girl, 8 years old, she watched her mother. Her mother died. She had a stepmother whom she loved, and she watched her stepmother being butchered in front of her. Then she was abducted into Gaza.
Emily.
8 years old. Emily Hand. And then she was released. And what did the Prime Minister say? He said she has been lost and has been found. And Or she has been found, or something like she went missing on Rosnaula Beach whilst going for a 99.
We noticed that in Israel. We noticed it.
Oh no! Listen, my wife was getting her hair done in a hairdresser. We were there, and next thing she could hear people in a mixture of Hebrew and English, all the people in the place start talking about the English Prime Minister saying this and the English Prime Minister saying that, and she had to interrupt and say, "Well, actually, it's not the English Prime Minister; it's the Irish Prime Minister." And then, of course, oy vey, you know. So then, everyone wanted to hear her thoughts on it. So yeah, it was the first time. You know, look, I've done stories in Uzbekistan, in Madagascar, in Chile, in Colombia, all over Australia, Vietnam, and being Irish is always a big plus. You know, oh, you're Irish, have a drink. You know, you're great fun. Let's play some music. You know, and you do, and you use that. You definitely use that, and you're not part of anything, you're kind of neutral in the middle, whatever. This is the first time that being Irish was a barrier, and you had to assure people that you're not like all the rest of them, that you're actually there to tell a truthful story, that you're not going to repeat lies, you know. So that was, you know, so I think we were perfectly positioned to do it because we are very experienced journalists. We've covered troubles before. We've covered people in difficult positions before, difficult situations before, but we weren't so close that we we could see the wood for the trees, you know.
Yeah, and the play is beautiful. I've read it, and I'm sure the production will be beautiful as well.
It'll be amazing. And Jeffrey Cantor, the director, is doing an amazing job. It's going to be on from, I'll just remind people, it's going to be on from May the 2nd to June the 16th at the Actors Temple Theatre in New York, October7theplay.com.
Yeah. October 7, the play. Follow us on all social media.
Thank you. Thank you, Al. So, Israel and the Jews, I mean, you're in a new world now in many ways, are you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of our worst instincts, let's say, or worst thoughts about our places in society came true. But at least we know where we stand.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you now. Like, we have friends here in LA, and one of them was telling us, well, she'd lost her best friend because her best friend basically said, well, what did you expect? And then she says, you know, my son, he lives up in Beverly Hills. He's bought a gun and he can't sleep at night. We have another friend who genuinely believes that they're going to come for her. And these people live in Los Angeles, you know, so it's a new world. It's a very interesting, of course, the left destroyed so much, and they destroyed my trust in the media. And when they tried, they always, do you remember, you know, a few years ago, the rise in anti-Semitism under Trump?
Oh, yeah.
And I was just going, you know, there's no rise in anti-Semitism. You're just weaponizing some loopers and pretending there's a rise.
Everybody changed their Twitter to like a blue square. And everybody is like, I stand against anti-Semitism. But I don't know. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think people only do it when it's easy for them.
Yeah. But then, interestingly, I actually thought that anti-Semitism was dead. I actually thought, because I never
so
met...
So did we.
We've been around the block. We've been to every state in the union, I would say, and spoken to conservatives all over the world, you know, and I've never heard I've heard one or two conservatives say something anti-Semitic, but it was never part of the conversation. In fact, I remember Ann Coulter at one of the presidential debates, I think it was 2012, saying, why are we having this stupid question on Israel for all the candidates? This is the Republican primary. She says, it's a waste of time. Everyone supports Israel. And they really, really support Israel. And they're just going to say that. And we all know that. So why? Let's move on to something that we disagree on. And she got, oh, well, that's Ann Coulter being anti-Semitic. No, she was truthful. It was like the most boring answer in the world. I support Israel 100%. Well, I support them 110%. Well, I support them 150%. Right? And I thought there's no anti-Semitism. Then once October 7 happened, it allowed the left to be anti-Semitic. Actually, I realized there was something going on. There was a book written a few years ago called Jews Don't Count.
Yeah, by David Baddiel.
Yeah. And I had thought, I remember watching the British election from a distance, and that the Labour Party leader, he was accused of being anti-Semitic. And I was going, that's just the right, weaponizing anti-Semitism as the right, as the left does about the right. And I thought it's just, when you read that book and you saw what Jeremy Corbyn actually did and actually said and actually believed, you realise, oh, he is quite anti-Semitic. So that was, to me, was going, oh, there's real anti-Semitism in the world.
And now people people try to say like, oh, it's not anti-Semitism, it's just anti-Zionism. But it never is. It never is just, first of all, criticism of Israel is not the same as denying the right of, you know, the only Jewish state to exist in any form. But, you know, it's cozying up and supporting terrorist organizations. It's spreading lies. It's spreading blood libels. So,
I mean, look, Jeremy Corbyn was liking posters and murals with hooked nosed people and with beards controlling the world. That was the level he was at. And it was like, I think that's anti-Semitic, Jeremy. But anyway, I knew then the left, there was something there in the left. And then it all exploded. It all was allowed to come out after October 7th. But very interesting, this is very serious for Israeli and for Jews, is that the right have now have started to peep their, some of them have started to peep their heads above the parapet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny. I haven't worked out whether it is, how many of them are anti-Semitic. See, there is a genuine political rationale for isolationism, right? Mm-hmm. American isolationism. Why are we helping Ukraine when Germany is not paying its way and Britain's not paying its way and France is not paying its way? Why are we getting involved in this foreign war when their neighbors in Poland and all those places should be putting in 10% of their GDP? I mean, and why are we putting our money over there when people are dying of fentanyl? I mean, there's all this. That's a genuine political.
Yeah,
argument,
those are
right?
legitimate questions to ask.
And you can actually then say, well, why are we helping Israel, right? And mm-hmm. you can actually there's a stronger argument of helping Israel is democracy in this area. But what's happening now is that I think people are using this isolationism. I mean, there's never any suggestion that we're going to send troops to Israel, right? Mm-hmm. But people are using this isolationist argument as a cover for anti-Semitism. And I'm talking mm-hmm. with you, Candace Owens, and other people. And so I think for Israelis and for Jews, that is a really dangerous. I mean, the best you can hope for now is that it becomes a partisan issue. Almost that
yeah
it becomes one of those issues where the right believe this and the left believe that, and you know you know who your friends are and you know who your enemies are. But if it becomes if the right starts to adopt, I mean, and by the way, that's what the right do, they adopt the toxicity of the left. The reason there was a January 6th was because they probably watched leftists burn every American city for a summer with no punishment, and why wouldn't you adopt the toxicity of the left and do what they did? So
yeah, it's the escalation of rhetoric and it's how easily we're comfortable spreading lies and talking about things we don't understand. I mean, look, if I believed what the students at Columbia believed, maybe I would also be protesting with them. The problem is they believe things that so many of them aren't, so much of the information they have is not true.
How much of it do you? How many true believers do you think there are, and how many are happy warriors just along for the fun?
That's a good question. I think there's a little bit of both. I think there is an Islamist fundamentalism component to it that everybody's afraid to talk about, but mm-hmm. there should be no reason to be afraid to talk about it. By the way, some of the bravest voices speaking out against Hamas are Muslims right now, but mm-hmm. they're correct. Not at Columbia, unfortunately. And I think a lot of it is people who if I have to be very generous, I would say they see a photo or they see a video of Gaza, and yeah, war is terrible, and I don't want to minimize that, but it appeals to their emotion in a way that makes them discount any other information they hear. And then you add to that a layer of you know, actual lies, like that Israel and I've heard them from very intelligent people that Israel is intentionally starving Gaza. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that Netanyahu, who I'm no big fan of, knew about the October 7th attack, but decided to let them go through because of, you know, his politics. Yep. I mean, these are, I hate to use the word blood libel, but like it's a modern day blood libel. Like these are just completely, they were created with the idea in mind of defaming Israel and the Jews.
I mean, you're right. They see pictures of war, and you know, look, war is not a war crime, mm-hmm. right? And people need to understand that. And actually, the media need to tell people that war is not a war crime. It's just because people die, civilians die in war, it's not a war crime. Just because children die in war, it's not necessarily a war crime.
Somebody asked me today on Twitter, he was trying to like own me, and he said, how many more Gazans do you want killed? And I wrote back, ideally zero. You know, I would like for no more people to be killed, not Palestinian, not Israeli, not anybody.
Yeah. Well, I understand that if Hamas were to surrender, mm-hmm. if the hostages were released, would that be grounds for an Israeli ceasefire?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, look, if the hostages are all released, it would be grounds for a ceasefire. It doesn't mean we're not going to give up on destroying Hamas. But at the end of the day, you come in, you take 133 people, many of them out of their beds in their pajamas. They go mm-hmm. through God knows what there. I mean, we do know because people are coming back, and they're coming back with harrowing stories. And I don't know what people expect us to do aside from ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, you're right about the people, you know, seeing the scenes from Gaza and then becoming emotional about it, and then having false facts. I mean, you know, Ben Shapiro, who is one of the, you know, is a great thinker and is a great thinker and is a great defender of values. He said, "Facts don't care about your feelings."
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I would say to Ben, feelings don't care about your facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we live in a feelings society now. Unfortunately, yeah. You know.
It's true. It's true. Look, I'm. You know, I see the pictures from Gaza like everybody else, and it doesn't make me happy. I'm not saying, yeah, go destroy them. But if, you know, if it's between, if we have to go in and destroy a building of which rockets are being launched still every day, to this day, I get alerts on my phone every time there's a rocket launched towards my family and my home, then, you know, then that building is going to be destroyed. It's not out of bloodlust and it's not out of love. It's about protecting our people. And it's our, not only it's our right, it's our duty to do that.
Yeah. Well, actually we have to wrap it up, unfortunately, but I mean, I have to say that if Israel is committing genocide, you're the world's worst genociders.
Yeah. We're also very bad at controlling the media.
Yes.
So we should work on that too.
But I mean, you know, if you really, I mean, look, Gaza's the size of a couple of football pitches, really. You know, I mean, it's not right, but it's, I mean, that was one thing that surprised me about Israel. Was the first time we'd been there. It's the size of Northern Ireland. You can travel it in
small.
A day. It's very small. So Gaza must be really, really small. And if you wanted to genocide Palestinians, Israel could do it in an afternoon, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
so,
I mean, but yeah, it's very true. And people have alluded to that, but I don't see why anybody would want to do that. And people don't understand that we go through this thought process like regular human beings as well.
Well, Yael, thank you very much for coming along to the show. Remind everyone how they can find you and then how they can find that wonderful play.
I was going to say, well, you can find me on Twitter at YaelBT. But more importantly, follow the play October 7th, the play on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Buy tickets. Come see the show. It's really going to be amazing. When you first told me that you're working on the show, you know, I said, well, this could go a lot of different ways. And it's very easy to take such a delicate subject and take the meaning out of it. But I think you did a wonderful job. And as an Israeli, as somebody who was there, it really spoke to me. And I think it was, you captured the essence very well. So I'm very, very excited to see it and to tell everybody I know.
Well, thank you. Thank you. As you say, it was a privilege doing it. It was an honor doing it. I'm hoping that I honor the story. Because as a journalist, that's all I want to do is tell the truth and honor the story.
Yeah.
And
well, I think you did that.
Well, thank you. So October 7th, theplay.com. Thank you, Yael.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
So yes, the play, October 7th, theplay.com. It's 100% verbatim. It's people's stories, heroism, survival, resilience, but also humor. Believe it or not, the Jews are that smart. They're such wonderful people that in the darkest days, they find jokes. That was a wonderful thing. That was a wonderful. It really is. We have a great job going around the world asking people questions. It's a great job being a journalist. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. But that was an amazing experience, and it was amazing to hear people make jokes and be humorous about their darkest days, their country's darkest day. So we're now going to go over to talk to Tom Nelson. Tom. You may remember Tom from the climate trial, in Mark Stein trial in DC. He interviewed us then many times when we covered it, and you can get the full details on the Mark Stein climate trial on Climate Change on Trial. Go and listen to that podcast. It's amazing. But let's go over to that interview I recorded with Tom earlier. We're joined now by Tom Nelson, the producer of the new movie, Climate, the movie. We had a great time with Tom during the Mark Stein trial, the Mark Stein defamation trial. Tom was one of the closest observers and commenters on the madness in DC, and being on his podcast was one of our one of the lighter times we had was great fun chewing the fat with Tom on that. Tom is an engineer and longtime climate skeptic, climate madness skeptic. He's pored over the data and found it full of flaws. He's the host of the Tom Nelson podcast. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the movie. What's the thesis? Tell us what it's called. Who's directed it? And what's the thesis? Why did you want to produce this movie?
Yeah, the movie is Climate, the movie, and it's kind of a follow up to Martin Durkin's 2007 film, The Great Global Warming Swindle. And Martin was on my podcast in October of 22, and he said, knowing what he knows now, he'd like the chance to kind of remake that and make the case in even a better way that there is no climate crisis. So that's the major thing. Maybe two-thirds of the movie talks about all the evidence that there is out there, that there is no climate crisis. CO2 is not the climate control knob. Weather's not getting worse. Pretty much everything, in fact, everything you've heard that's alarming about the climate, about humans causing something bad to happen to the climate, none of that stuff is true. So it talks about that. And then in the second part of the movie, Martin lays out the case talking about the politics of it. Like, why is this being forced on us?
Mm-hmm. So who's interviewed in the movie? Is it a bunch of nobodies or you know, I mean, because the scientific consensus says we're in a crisis. So who did you get to interview?
Yeah, it is not a bunch of nobodies. One person we have is the 2022 Nobel Prize winner in physics, John Clauser. He talks in the movie. You see him several times. He's calling this a crock. And yeah, he's dug into it. Clearly, we're told that this is all basic physics and kids in grade school can understand that CO2 is the climate control knob, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we have the Nobel Prize winner, a fresh Nobel Prize winner, talking about the fact that it's not, that the whole narrative that we're being fed is just riddled with lies. And we also have Will Happer, a very, very highly respected scientist. We have Richard Lindzen and a whole bunch of other folks that have dug carefully into this. And they're not crazy people. We have Steve Koonin as well, who's been an advisor to in presidential administrations. They're just people that are willing to speak out and go against the narrative. So many other people, I think, agree with them, but they have not been able to speak out because they get canceled. You lose funding, and it's way easier to not speak out.
So one of the most kind of egregious misrepresentations of climate data that are circulated by science and their friends in the media. Well, tell us some of the most egregious.
Most egregious parts of the narrative?
Yeah, you know, that the scientists push out and that are circulated by the media.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've been involved in this debate kind of daily since about 2006 or so, and I just see the same narratives over and over. Just, for example, forest fires. Anytime there's a forest fire, we're told, hey, look at this. It's because of our sins of emitting CO2 and burning hydrocarbon fuel. That has made it hotter and drier, and it's causing more forest fires. That's just one example. But if you look at the actual data on forest fires, as we do in the movie, you can see that the forest fires in the U.S., for example, in the first half of the 20th century are just mind-blowingly worse than anything we've seen since then. So the whole idea that CO2 is the forest fire control knob, there's no evidence at all that supports that.
Sorry, say that again. The first half of the 20th century, there's more.
Yes, in the first half of the 20th century, between 1900 and 1950, you can look at a graph, and the number of acres burned back then was way, way higher than anything we've seen since then. Of course, there's a lot of factors that control how much forest burns, and CO2 is not one of them. CO2 is a minor factor in climate, but certainly it's not causing the earth to be on fire like the narrative kind of says.
Yeah. And why did this movie have to be made now? Like, you know, why did Martin and yourself, why is it right for now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it is just a happy accident that it came out now. It just happens that, like I said, October 2022, he decided to remake it. But I think it's just perfect timing because the people are so much more willing to accept or to listen to this now because they've heard so many other lies. Constantly, as I'm talking to people, pretty much every day, they're saying that their eyes have been opened because of all the other lies we've been told in the last 4 years. I'm hearing that over and over, with especially the COVID lies.
Yeah.
People are saying, okay, what else are they lying to us about? And they start looking at climate. And if you are objective person, you look at the data for yourself, you right away, you find out they're lying to us over and over and over. And again, every single alarming thing about polar bears or droughts or floods or whatever, all of it's a lie.
It's funny you should say that. I don't want to give away too much, but a very, very famous person realized that the gender nonsense was nonsense, right? And started speaking about it. I don't want to be too specific, and started falling in with these people who agreed with him, and of course they were right wing. And he spent a lot of time, this famous person has spent a lot of time with them, and has seen that they're real, but also has seen that how the media misrepresents something that he knows to be untrue. And he literally turned to them one day and he goes, I know that the media has misrepresented this, and I know that the gender, and I can see all the science, and I can know why, what the background. And he says, but this climate thing, it's real, isn't it? And they were going, sorry, it's not. And he goes, I just knew. He had realized something was not right in one thing, and thought, well, sounds awfully like that climate scam thing too. Is that a scam also? So you're right. Lots of people have been woken up in the last 4 years by, it doesn't matter what their gateway drug is, and now they've realized, everything, there's so much that we're being lied about.
Yeah, you definitely don't have to be a climatologist. That people are kind of figuring that out, that ordinary people have the ability to sanity check things that they've been told. And you can do this. You can check out the polar bear stuff for yourself, and you'll find out that for sure there's way more polar bears now than there were during the global cooling scare in the 1970s.
I do remember asking Al Gore about that question once at the Society of Environmental Journalists, where I had him on the ropes about the increase of polar bears which went against his movie, actually. And the Society of Environmental Journalists responded by turning off my microphone by protecting Al Gore. So that's yes, I do remember that story very well. So you talked about the second half of it, is why we're being told this lie. What's the politics? So why do governments have an interest in making ordinary people scared of climate change?
Yeah, even I have learned a lot about this just in the last year. I've had a Jacob Nordengard on my podcast a couple times. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he talks about how this whole scare goes way back into decades ago, into the 50s, et cetera, that there really are elites, self-described elites, that really do see this as a way to control us. I was not buying that at first, but if you can control carbon, you can control life. And that's what we talk about in the movie, that if they really do sell this whole thing to us, then they can control how much we fly and how much meat we eat and our thermostat temperature and all sorts of things, especially if they have a central bank digital currency to turn everything off or on. So it is a way to control us. And if you're a Malthusian and you're worried about overpopulation, maybe this is another way to maybe control population even.
Yeah,
it's ahead.
The Saudis have shown that, and the Russians have shown that if you control carbon, you can basically tell countries and people what to do.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is a global thing. It's not like any sort of a little local thing about picking up garbage or whatever. It's they desperately needed some sort of a global thing, and they pushed all their chips into this thing. And I'm happy it's crumbling. From my perspective, they pushed all their chips in, and it's not going to work because the whole thing is so stupid. People are not going to buy it. People are too smart to buy into this whole thing. They're not going to eat the bugs for this.
I don't know, Tom. I mean, look, you know, there's so much you can, climate change. As I used to say, climate change, why is climate going to destroy the world? I mean, there's it's very, very hot in Singapore, and it's very, very cold in Finland. Those are two countries doing very well. Climate is not destiny. Bad politics is destiny, but that, I'm not sure. I mean, how do we combat these dangerous messages? I mean, how do we, if you say that they're on the ropes, how do we kick them to the ground and stomp on their face?
So In the movie, people are asking, how are we ever going to convert to people who have gone all in, like the Michael Manns, the Catherine Hayhoes? How are we going to convince them that they're wrong? And we're not trying to do that. I think a certain percentage of people are all the way in, and they're going to go to their graves still believing this. It's way too painful to realize they were wrong this entire time. But I do think there's a huge number of people, I don't know what that percentage is, but it's a very large percentage of the people who are, haven't gone all in. They've kind of casually believed in it, but they haven't really thought about it. And all kinds of people like that can be convinced by a movie like this or just by talking to people. Even if you see people in your ordinary life and they say stuff about being worried about how hot it is, you can point out how hot it was in the 1930s. And Tony Heller does a good job of pointing all this stuff out about historical data is maybe the key to making people not worried about what's happening now. You can, if there's a storm right now and they don't know anything about history, they might think this is the worst storm ever. But if you can constantly show them that whatever's happening now, it's happened in the past too, that there's no reason to panic. And people have panicked about bad weather for as far as we know throughout human history, and they've blamed other humans for it throughout human history.
Well, it's all, obviously
bad weather is caused by people you don't like. That's an old and stupid thing.
Well, it's either the Jews or the witches, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, there was this whole thing about witch burning that people were actually killed in the maybe tens of thousands of people were killed because there was bad weather during the Little Ice Age.
That's right.
And people thought the solution was get rid of the witches because it was their fault.
Well, isn't there, there's a D.C. congressman who believes the Jews control the weather. Isn't that right? Or
I don't know about that, but
Yeah. No. I mean, look, you'll always find the least favorite group to blame for bad weather or for whatever, the failure of the crops, you know. So I know the movie has been suppressed. Of course it is, because we live in that age of suppression and censorship. But how can people watch this movie? How can they make it a success? And they have to make it a success.
Yeah, they can go to climatethemovie.net and they can watch it there. And I am happy to report that a lot of people have gone to my Substack and they've downloaded a copy of the full movie and clips from the movie. A lot of people have downloaded that and then put that up on their own channels.
Wonderful.
And we're not, it's completely free. We encourage that. If you want to download a copy and put it up on your own X feed or put it up on Substack or whatever, you can do that. And a lot of people have done that. So there's copies of it. I think there's over 100 full copies of it out there now.
Great. Wonderful. Well, people need to watch this. Please go. What's your Substack, Tom?
You can just find, it's just Tom Nelson Substack. If you Google for that, you should find it.
Or go to climatethemovie.net. Please spread this far and wide. We'll put the links in the notes under the podcast. Thank you very much, Tom, and hope to talk to you soon.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate your support.
Bye.
All right. Goodbye.
So that's great. Climate, the movie, is free to watch on YouTube and other places. Please watch it. Please comment on it. It's being suppressed, as Tom said. So let's make it a success. Now, Trump derangement syndrome is an awful disease. So awful. Like Salman Rushdie, who was an author, he wrote the Satanic Verses. He was put under a fatwa by the Iranian Ayatollah. And he had to go into hiding. And I mean proper hiding. I mean, he couldn't stay in the one home for more than a few days for years. Eventually, he felt the fatwa was lifted. He gave, he came out with books. He was winning prizes. He moved to New York. He divorced a few wives, as you do. And he married another one. And then he was giving a speech, a literary speech at upstate New York, and an Islamic terrorist came up and stabbed him 14 times, including once in the eye, and he lost the eye. So he's now written a book about that called Knife Meditations After an Attempted Murder. And it really is a study in stupidity. And I want just to go through an interview he gave to the Daily Telegraph to show how the state of the literary world is just appalling if this is their leading author. By the way, I tried to read the Satanic Verses when it came out. I had a small part to play. He used to come to the bookshop I worked in London. Reporters used to come in and say, could you tell me where Salman Rushdie's house is? And I'm going, I'm not going to tell you where Salman Rushdie's house is. I had his address in the, because we used to deliver books to it. So anyway, he gave this interview. I just want to read some quotes. I'd had more than two decades of leading a perfectly ordinary writer's life, he said. Literary events, sitting at home, writing, going around town. I told myself there really wasn't much to be bothered about anymore. I guess I was wrong. He was wrong. And then the bit I get was minimal security at the Chautauqua event. This is upstate New York. But I don't blame it at all. But I don't blame them at all. The thing about Chautauqua people is that they're really sweet people. It's an innocent world, leafy and quiet and full of liberal people. And I think they thought we're in this nice little place. Nothing ever happens here. It didn't occur to them. And it's like, look, predators sense weakness. Nice, leafy, liberal places emanate weakness. Of course, you know, do you remember they had the Muhammad cartoon down in Texas where they had a prize giving for the best anti-Muhammad cartoon, and two Islamic terrorists turned up to create a massacre and everyone was armed and shot them before they almost got out of the car? That's what happens in non-liberal places. In liberal places like Chautauqua, the guy can walk up, get on stage and stab you 14 times before they realize what's happening because they're weak. What I like was that when he was under the original fatwa, the Thatcher, he was the biggest anti-Thatcherite, just one of those reflexive, boring anti-conservatives. And he even says that in the interview. I've been quite a critic of the Thatcher government, so they didn't love me, but they did the right thing, and I was always grateful for that. So Maggie Thatcher, the big conservative, kept you safe. The liberals in Chautauqua didn't. But he doesn't, the great author, the great thinker of the 21st century doesn't put two and two together and get four. You know, and then there's a line in the interview. You know, he always thought the dangers would come from hired killers, you know. He could not have conceived that it would come 29 years later from a lone fanatic. By the way, he's not a lone fanatic. He's part of a mass movement. He may have carried out the attempted murder on his own, but he is part of a mass movement. He's part of an ideology. He's part of a religion. And if you think he's a lone assassin, then it's going to happen again and again. And it does happen. Mark Sines talks about the society of lone wolves. Of course they're going to do it on their own. It's, you know, if 15 young Muslim men had arrived at that event, the alarm bells would have gone off. Of course they do it on their own. That's what happens. So, and then we get to the piece of the resistance. And what is the author thinking now with a presidential election 7 months away and Rushdie lives in New York? And he thinks, I'm going to make the same mistake again. I think he might lose. And if he wins, unbearable, unthinkable, because he'll be much worse this time. He'll be unleashed. He's a liar and a bully. This is Trump, and cares about nothing except himself. And if Trump does return to the White House, Rushdie says, America would be, quote, unlivable. It's seriously what I think. You're the guy who got stabbed 14 times and lost your eye under Biden. And you think America would be unlivable because Trump would be there? My children want me to come back to London. I've always been torn about having almost all my close family live in London and be living there. So would he return? I might do. And what would stop him? Of course, what would stop him? Politics, Brexit. Because I think the damage done to England, not just economically, but culturally, is just so awful. And that's mad too. So for you, a choice of two evils. So living in America. So living in Biden, getting stabbed 14 times, including once in the eye, is not evil. But so for you, a choice of two evils. Yes. But one evil has my family in it. That's Trump. So that is the state of the literary world. These are the top writers, the top thinkers. I just really want to talk a little bit about the Cass report, and maybe next week we'll have someone on to talk about it. There was a report into gender identity treatment services for children in the UK. It's the Cass report. Google the Cass report. It's an amazing document. Children were just railroaded into surgery and into treatment and into puberty blockers. And most people changed their minds without treatment, but they were not given. A lot of the people were autistic. They had eating disorders. They were traumatized. They had other things going on. But to the ideologues in the gender treatment services, it was all about getting them in, getting them on puberty blockers, stopping them developing. And then when they didn't develop, the only solution for them then was to solve that problem that they had created was to get them into mutilating surgery. So, and she said social transition is the big problem. Calling Mary Fred is the start of the problem, because then the next step is puberty blockers. Then that is just, and everyone accepts it, and there's no easy way of getting off it. Please listen, go read about the CAS report. And we will have someone on next week to talk about it in detail. But for now, if you're in New York between May 2nd, June 16th, we want to see you at the October 7th play. If you're not there, you can go and donate or buy a ticket for your friends on October 7th, the play. I'm going to leave now with the trailer of the play. We're going to play that as we go out. So thank you very much for listening, and talk to you next week. It'll be myself and Anne McElhinney. Thank you. Bye.
The world wants you to forget what happened in Israel on October 7th. We've covered many shocking stories, but nothing comes close to what the men, women and children of Israel faced that day. We're investigative journalists, Anne McElhinney and Phelan McAleer.
We travelled to Israel after October the 7th and talked to those who lived through that day. Their stories are tragic, they are moving and they are heroic. They are also very, very compelling.
We've produced a play from their stories. Our verbatim play, October 7, consists entirely of eyewitness accounts of that day, only using the actual words of those who lived through it. The world wants you to forget about what happened that day, the day that everything changed. We refuse to let that happen.
October 7, the play, is opening in New York and will bring you the truth they don't want you to hear.
Get your tickets now for October 7, the play, at October7theplay.com, running May 2nd to June 16th in New York.
That's October7theplay.com. Thank you.